Dave, thanks very much for the introduction and for the invitation to talk today. I think Katrina and I will start by introducing each other or ourselves, I should say, and our approach to thinking about research and practice and language and communication in fine art. Then I'll introduce the project. Katrina and I will talk about Katrina will talk about the crit pedagogy and history, and then I'll present some data from the institutional research that we've been collaborating on, and then we'll end with a discussion which I hope you'll engage in as well. Thank you. I'll see if I can. Great, it's working. Fantastic. It's always good when the slide when the technology is working. Just to say that I'm a researcher at the University of the Arts with a background in applied linguistics. I currently work for the Decolonizing Arts Institute at the university where I met Katrina. I've been interested in ways in which racialized and linguistically minoritized students are positioned in universities. I joined the university as a project researcher on a project called Reimagining Conversations, which was developed to examine interaction with international students specifically in order to raise awareness of the educational and the creative potential of the use of language. Currently, I work as a research fellow and support art and design colleagues on a research scheme called the Decolonizing Arts Education Secondment Scheme. Over to you, Katrina.
Thank you, Victoria. Yes, my name is Katrine Gjelde. I am Norwegian and I'm now in Norway, but I have been working for a very long time at the University of Arts London. I come from what we call fine art. I have been a course leader and a tutor, practice and theory tutor for many years in the fine art context, and now I am department leader here in Bergen in Norway. And I met Victoria because I was for a year I was an associate researcher with the Decolonizing Arts Institute, and my interest is in kind of thinking about how to decolonize aspects of fine art pedagogy, and of course the crit is a crucial aspect of that pedagogy. So it's been very amazing to work with Victoria on this
Thank you, Katrina.
Project.
So what I'll do now is introduce the project, our approach to the project and methodology. The approach to the institutional research at the university, a specialist art and design university, draws on the traditions of linguistic methodology as approach and method, drawing on the work of Creese and Blackledge, which, for example, combines ethnographic fieldwork and the finely grained analysis of classroom interactional data. I found that during the project and developing the methodology, that my role was one of institutional researcher, but also it had links and an overlap with the institutional practice of artist in resident and researcher in residence. And I think that was particularly, I found that particularly be relevant for a research project which sought to effect change. I'm aware of the colonial roots of linguistics. Ben Rampton suggests that there are claims that ethnography as well hasn't completely shaken off its origins. Yet I think the links between the microanalysis and the broader institutional practices and the relationships that are developed have proved productive over the months and years. So observation and interview took place online and in person, and I engaged in retrospective interviews and document analysis in different sites across the university. And again, this aligned with other institutional practices. I found that the principles of ethnographic monitoring, which were first developed by Himes and then have been more recently taken up by van der Aar and Blommert, were particularly relevant, and that they focused on a four-stage approach of consultation with relevant actors, relevant tutors, students and other members of staff, field work which was influenced or by observation, findings and dissemination of those findings amongst the actors and the institution, and then evaluation. However, in practice, this four-stage approach has been, it's been iterative and much more, you know, much messier. Although the approach is relevant, and Katrina is one of those actors who I would say has influenced my thinking has had involvement in the later stages of the project. So that's the methodological approach. And now I'll talk briefly about some of the more the coloniality of language and pedagogy, and why Katrina and I felt that this was perhaps a useful lens through which to, on the one hand, question classroom and institution equalities and practices, but also a very useful framework for beginning to think about and problematize what it means to communicate in art school, and the privileges of European knowledge and language use, and the way in which some of the dominant practices perhaps invisibilize the languages and the worldviews of other people and other forms of knowledges. So first of all, coloniality, drawing on Maldona Torres's notion of coloniality, which is that it refers to long-standing patterns of power that emerge as a result of colonialism, but that also define culture, labor, intersubjective relations and knowledge production well beyond the strict limits of colonial illustration. So from this perspective, Maldonado and Torres think of coloniality as that or anything which survives colonialism. Also related to this approach is the British colonial legacy, where English is seen as the language of power and status, and the potential impact that has on the world and educational context today. Starting with the issue that one of the issues with the colonial project was that language use was a significant part of that in terms of training, and the colonial imposition of languages and knowledges, and which languages and knowledges should be valued, and the cultural capital associated, and the enduring cultural capital associated with English, French, Portuguese and other languages. The consequence of that is that the knowledge of those who do not speak those languages or who are not dominant in colonial or post-colonial languages, that one of the consequences, according to Roy Campbell, is that those languages are, the individuals are devalued, seen as deficient, or to cite Caroline McKinney, are even seen as deviant, i.e. deliberately a kind of obfuscating challenges. So there is a legacy of English in particular, which is relevant for not only the UAL or the British higher education context, and I think Katrina may talk about that a little later, but the fact that English is seen as a language with status, power and privilege, it has socioeconomic mobility status and is desirable for that in that sense. But I think one of the consequences is that some people and some of our students in highly diverse and internationalized universities are placed in more privileged positions of power, whereas other students and social actors are perhaps positioned in more marginalized positions. So finally, in terms of continued work in an international university. The final point that relates to our framing is the notion of Western pedagogic traditions and the privileging and emphasis of orality and dialogue as an approach to examining spaces and the way in which dialogue is privileged and indeed exploratory talk, which imposes values and perhaps culturally laden and culturally specific practices upon diverse groups of students. So we've given an introduction to the research project and the approach to institutional research, and also our framing around the coloniality of language and pedagogy. And now I think the next point is that Katrina will talk about the crit and what it means. And I'll pass over to you, Katrina.
Thank you, Victoria. So for those of you who are familiar with the art school, very familiar with the art school, will know that the crit is not one thing across all subjects, like different disciplines like fine art or design or architecture have developed their own kind of cultures around the crit. And my primary knowledge is around the fine art crit, although I have also taught in other subjects. It is usually happens at a time when work is being shown in a public or semi-public way, which means that there is a sense of audience and the kind of expectation around articulation of intention and what the work is about. I think the students often come to the crit thinking that they will get a judgment, you know, that it will be decided whether this work is kind of successful or not so successful. Whereas, and I think that is something that varies again between different cultures and languages, but actually is one thing that is pretty often quite a unifying expectation across a student group. But certainly what is less clear to the students is what we are actually really expecting, which as tutors, which is that this is a place for students to begin to develop their own ability to articulate their thinking around art. And that doesn't just involve their own art explaining what they have made, but actually even more importantly, perhaps to be able to kind of articulate how they see the work of their peers, what they might interpret as a problem or something that's successful. How do they do that? How what is the language that they use? And the kind of ideally also then to develop a criticality around this language. And certainly, you know, working with Victoria, I mean, I was already very interested in the crit as a kind of one of those places that are contested and often problematic in art education. It can be something that students are kind of nervous about, dreading, and it will often kind of play to those who are more extrovert or confident. And as Victoria was saying earlier, it privileges those who are in a way positioned as the knowers, and that would often be those who are in full command of the English language, and that is the dominant or that's the main language within that group. I don't know if you'd like to add some things to that, Victoria.
No, I think that's okay. Perhaps if you could talk briefly about the role of the crit as you see it. You've talked about the crit as a semi-public space, but I wondered if you could talk about briefly the role of the crit as you see it in relation to fine arts students' professional development.
Yeah, this is a really important thing, because one of the reasons why we are really prioritise the crit and this focus on being able to speak about own practice, but also that of the practice of others, is that we know that in the world, art is surrounded by discourse. So this is about giving students agency and being able to be the ones who kind of have a position in relation to their own practice. They're not kind of dependent on someone else to come and do this work for them, and particularly in the UK system, where most art students, certainly on the BA level, we know that most of them do not become, in a way, successful artists in the sort of selling art through a gallery kind of way. The vast majority go into all kinds of roles and work that often arts or culturally related, but not necessarily as a producing artist in terms of producing art objects. So this is actually also a super important aspect of their in what we might call their employability or their or you know, how they can then navigate the world and find a place there. And this is different in different cultures and contexts, because we so it, in the UK, and this is something that I'm actually very interested in, there is a sense that educating artists who then don't necessarily become artists in the strictest sense of the word is contributes really importantly to society, but of course that usually then happens through discourse, through speaking, writing, etc.
Thank you. Now I'm going to now talk through two examples, two data examples. So that the first occurred last summer in a suburb of South London, where called Peckham, which is an area of London that is currently undergoing quite rapid gentrification. So 20 years ago, Peckham was perhaps thought of as an inner city area with issues of social deprivation, but now it's changing quite rapidly. And I felt that this was I was delighted to be invited to observe a crit that occurred in a safe house, which I think is an interesting dynamic in terms of seeing the crit as a safe space to engage in dialogue and exploration, and the fact that it took place in a safe house, a place where at some point the police housed people in safety, or it was used as a way of hiding from the police. So I thought that was an interesting metaphor. During this space, there were around 20 or so students who were, as Katrina has said, displaying their artwork and their work in progress, not only to a university audience, to their tutors, but to tutors external to the university, and indeed in a space that was deliberately external to the university. During this time, during the day, students would take it in turns, and they were engaging in exploratory, open conversations with tutors and indeed with their peers. What these fieldwork notes highlight, I think, is that there are perhaps some tensions between the crit as seen as not so much as an opportunity for career development and an exploration and a discursive space, but I think there are tensions between the crit as described as an exploratory, dialogic, discursive space, which is non-hierarchical and perhaps non-threatening. So in this example of a crit, there were around 20 students, but two tutors. And this very short fragment, this interaction, is between two highly specialist tutors. So the student is presenting their artwork, and the first tutor asks a question: have you thought about working much bigger? I think you would really benefit from working bigger. So automatically we can see that rather than being only an exploration of artwork and practice, that the tutor is evaluating. There's some evaluative language. The tutor then follows up by saying, I find the size of the painting really limiting. However, the second tutor in the space disagrees with the first tutor. And I think that it can be problematic or challenging, perhaps for students who are perhaps less experienced or of fine art crits, to know who and when and how to respond to the different evaluations of their artwork. And then the second tutor responds, I'm really interested in colour, so not the size, but in the colour. It felt quite juvenile to me. So in this example, rather than being only an exploration, there is a sense that both tutors are evaluating and indeed evaluating the individual student's artwork negatively. Of course, there are pedagogic reasons and there are developmental reasons for this. But this is, again, as Katrina has said, it's in a public space. I'm present, another, a second tutor is present, and there are the students' cohort as well. So this is the first example, I think, of ethnographic fieldwork where what actually takes place and an examination of dialogue is quite revealing in terms of who is privileged and who has the confidence, the agency, the ability to respond appropriately. In the second example, this is slightly different. In this example, it's drawing on linguistic analysis of transcription. I've highlighted in this example, after several hours of online observation, a highly sophisticated and specialist tutor who sets up a dialogue between two students, Aileen and Connie. So the tutor starts by saying, I wonder if a starting point for the dialogue, for the crit, would be, you know, can you talk a little bit more about what the intentions are? Because potentially these two different directions have quite distinct intentions. So the student has said, I'm developing my practice, my illustrations in this example, and I could go in two different directions. So the student, Aileen, who I perceive as being in the observation, an English dominant speaker. She speaks slowly, deliberately. There are pauses, she sighs, and then there's another pause. My intentions, and there are lots of fillers. Well, the intention with like. So we can see from this fragment of interaction that the opportunity that Aileen has been given to take the floor in the space and talk about her own art practice and development is potentially challenging for her. There are fillers, and she's not necessarily very clear about how to take this. So she continues by saying, the project was like kind of, you know, to give a place for an object that has such like a weight in history. So she continues to speak deliberately. And then she then responds to the illustrations that she's developing and her desire to, you know, how can we find a place for it in the 21st century? And that's kind of where what I'm trying to do with these illustrations. There's a rising tone which suggests that Aileen is tentative about the development and the direction of her project. This is followed by further pauses. And then she ends the utterance by saying, I don't know, twice. I don't know. Does that cover? Does that make sense? What I just said? I don't know. So there's then latching, and the tutor is very positive, encouraging tone, and says, let's take that to the group. Aileen then responds with a humph. She perhaps is signalling some dissatisfaction, I think, with the way she performed in the crit in this example. Later on in the crit, there is an exchange between Aileen, who's listening, so she's back channeling, she's saying rather quietly as she listens to the tutor and also to her peer, Connie. So Connie is an international student, but again, an English dominant speaker. So Connie says, in response to Aileen's art that she's presenting, you know, rather than like being, oh, and then Connie takes on an assumed voice, a performative stylized voice. She says this is a modern take on, I don't know, an Egyptian painting. So she adopts a voice that is not her usual voice. Again, to I would suggest drawing on the work of Julia Snell and stylized performance in classroom spaces in schools, that she adopts this voice because she wants to, on the one hand, maintain her friendship and affiliations with her fellow colleague who have been supportive, but on the other hand, has been placed in a space where she needs to evaluate and critique her friend's work, which she finds difficult. So therefore, one solution to the discomfort that she feels is to adopt a voice that is not her own. So in response to this point, this performance, Aileen laughs cautiously and Connie says, again, I don't know, yeah, that's really Aileen back channels. The tutor also is supportive as well in that space, showing that they're listening. So in this response, Aileen is supportive and says, oh yeah, no, that's a really good point. So she agrees with her friend, with her peer. But then immediately there's a rebuttal. I'm halfway through the article that you suggested some time ago, like ages ago. It's really wordy, and she laughs. I had to break it up a little bit. So there's support for Connie's feedback and Connie's evaluation of her illustration practices, but there's also an implicit criticism that Aileen chooses to comment on the advice that Connie had given her previously. So I think, like the previous example of the interaction between the tutors in the safe house, in this example, the crit shows that, yes, on the one hand, it is exploratory, open dialogue, but that dialogue, perhaps, which has traditions in Western pedagogic thinking and Western pedagogic teaching, is potentially challenging for the students who are involved, despite the highly sophisticated support and the sensitive way in which both tutors in both examples set up the crit. And I think that this second fragment of linguistic data illustrates that there is a privileging of talk, perhaps over listening. And I know that Katrina's going to talk about this a little bit later, but there does seem to be a privilege of conversation, of talk, as opposed to some of the other multimodal and multi-semiotic resources that can be used and drawn on for communication practices. So what we thought we would do now is, as our relationship is evolving, and we have, we thought we would share just some conversations that we've had, and we'd like to highlight perhaps and problematize some of the practices, linguistic and communication practices, but also other pedagogic practices. And then we'll talk about briefly about what we see as perhaps one way forward to decolonizing and decentering some of the long-standing traditions around the crit. And as I say that, Katrina, I'm mindful of the conversation that we had previously around some of the language of the crit in the first example. Do you want me to return to that slide now? Would that be helpful? Or shall we pick it up later?
Yeah, let's go back to that slide. Everyone can see the slide with fine art examples. So, I mean, this is a really, really excellent snippet that Victoria has brought to our attention here. And interestingly, you know, often when we select tutors to do a crit, we want tutors to embody or to kind of present different positions, positionalities within fine art practice. So there isn't a sense of the expert or the kind of the right way or the best way, but rather that the tutors at least present in a way, often quite different positions, in order for students to see that there are many ways to think about art and discuss it and talk around this practice. The other thing to think about here is around, and again, very interestingly, what Victoria was saying, you know, this desire to keep things open, to kind of unpack, but how quickly it still returns to a kind of a judgment or evaluation. So not all, even if tutors intend to not do that, it happens all the time. And I think it happens in part because of the traditions or expectations around art and this idea of where this conversation might take us is so bound up with the idea of the evaluation or the judgment in practice. Another thing to think about here is in terms of the language is the words like bigger. I mean, this has a particular kind of history within Western art, for instance, so which we then often don't problematize. You know, where does that idea come from that something very large is better? It's seen as maybe more ambitious, it's seen as kind of more expansive, it maybe relates to ideas around the sublime, you know, whatever it might be, that has this kind of idea that there's something very valuable about scaling something up. And we don't, and in a crit, we don't necessarily stop at that moment and think, hang on, what does this word suggest? You know, what are we actually saying when we use this word? It's also a word that can be seen as perhaps kind of connected to maybe gender. I mean, this is a different discussion perhaps, but it's also interesting to think that none of these words are in any way neutral. They're always related to other things, and sometimes those things are very specific for fine art practice, and other times they're related to a kind of more broad kind of use of those same words in certainly in Western society, but which it may again not be picked up. The nuances of that may be quite obvious to all those who are English speaking or English culture background, but not to students who for whom English is their second or third language, for instance.
Thank you. And I think I found that to be a really useful example of how an adjective, you know, a comparative adjective like bigger has quite long-standing histories. Yeah. You know, it has a history. Small words have big histories, and yes, they are tied up and bound up in not only how we communicate on interaction on an individual interpersonal level, but they're also the language of fine art is also bound up in other cultural and educational histories and pedagogies, which perhaps we can move on to discuss in the last slide. So the question, I think the question for us is, you know, to what extent in internationalized universities in the West, now, to what extent is it indeed possible to decolonize the crit? And we thought that we would perhaps talk through a number of points and then draw our conclusions and possible ways forward. So the first point relates to English language use in multiple English medium instruction context. So again, I think Katrina and I were discussing to what extent this was a form of coloniality, to what this was a form of new colonial practices. And I don't know, Katrina, if you wanted to talk about the context in Norway.
Yes. So, for instance, now that I'm in Norway, you know, our MA here and in the academy is run in English. So, of course, it's kind of an imported language. And the idea for that is that we want to kind of connect to have a wider student group than just students from Norway. We want to also connect our students to the world. So English is seen as a kind of a crucial aspect of that. But at the same time, we do need to think about what it means and how the language itself might be upholding structures or positions that we are actually actively trying to undo, but where the framework of language always brings us back to those things at the same time.
Sure, sure. So I think linguistically, English remains a powerful model for a variety of reasons. And I'm sort of returning to the definition of coloniality as that which survives colonialism. I think that for me, as an applied linguist working within a decolonizing arts research space, that I think it relates to what perhaps Quijano talks about in relation to a taxonomy of colonialism and coloniality, that there is significant talk and thinking in terms of power, knowledge, being, nature, privilege, but quite often language is missing from debates around decoloniality. And I would suggest that you can't really tackle decolonizing institutional spaces without tackling language and the role of languages in knowledge making practices. So the second point, I think we've touched on that, relates to pedagogy and dominant pedagogy. And for me, I think there are tensions between what is considered to be desirable pedagogic practice, which is student-centered, dialogic and exploratory, where there is space for engagement and discussion in the way that Katrina has framed the crit as a particularly discursive space. But this dialogic tradition is very firmly located in the Western tradition of dialogue as being desirable and talk being desirable. And I think a question for me this raises is that the crit is a form of talk that is exploratory and developmental and in a semi-public space, but there is it privileges talk over listening, and it privileges talk over other forms of communication, and that's something that's perhaps troubling in terms of the enduring popularity and dominance of Paulo Freire's work on dialogic talk, on dialogue as a tool for emancipatory action, and the way in which dialogic talk may indeed privilege some but marginalize perhaps our non-Western students who come from a very different tradition, where there is greater understanding, acceptance and tolerance of not talking, of silence, of listening. Katrina, do you want to comment on that?
Yeah, just very briefly, because I think there's a sense in other cultures, some cultures, where listening is a kind of a very respectful activity, and it's highly encouraged. And I think sometimes we would see as a student, perhaps, for instance, in the UK context, who isn't what we call, what might see as active, because they're not speaking, but they might be incredibly actively listening, and that there isn't value placed on that, and there isn't a kind of a way to find how can that be captured, are there other ways of contributing that aren't necessarily about speaking up, which can be challenging, certainly if you're also not used to speaking publicly in a different language, but also different personality types. There are lots of people who struggle with that kind of place and space for speech for a number of reasons.
Thank you. And again, as you're speaking, I'm reminded of the popular and current work in the field of raciolinguistics, which emphasises the importance and the role of the listener as well as the speaker. To what extent that has a place and status in Western universities, I think is another question, particularly when we consider assessment regimes and what is and what can be and what is the potential for assessment practices. The third point, again, this is what I've learned from Katrina, and I think the examples of going into the crit space that I shared, the way in which language affects the production of artwork and a sense to what extent, if we privilege talk and dialogue and discussion over other forms of communication? Are we reproducing the colonial acts of domination? Katrina, can I?
Yeah, I think this is a really important aspect, and I, and this harks back to my kind of interest in art pedagogy, and the way it privileges certain kinds of colonial histories and stories within art, so that through language we can kind of in effect and reproduce or continue to position or uphold the hierarchies that exist that we can see are colonial, but we don't seem to find a way to kind of go outside of it somehow with because of language. And but that doesn't mean we shouldn't try it. It means that we just really need to begin to discuss that, and maybe by having a conversation around a kind of a non you know, a sort of seemingly not very important word like bigger, we can actually begin to address expectations, notions of evaluation, kind of lineages of art history or kind of cultural production, and see, you know, where does that idea come from, that bigger may be better, and then we can kind of think about whether or not this is an appropriate conversation to have in relation to a particular student's work, or maybe at all.
So I'm mindful of time, and I just have a perhaps one or two more points to make. And I think, just following on from that knowledge and cultural production, I think the examples that we've shown today and the discussions we have show that there's a vulnerability that's necessary, which can be more challenging if perhaps as a student or a tutor you feel that you don't necessarily belong, or the space in which the crit and the dialogue is taking place is not perhaps perceived to be safe. And there's a sense that conversations are uncomfortable, knowledge production is uncomfortable and even violent at times, and the question is, does it have to be? And that's where we find that the framing of decolonizing and decoloniality is very useful for thinking about how we can improve practice and how we can make fine art crits, which is the focus of today's talk, a safer space, and indeed a more comfortable space. And I'm going to pass over to Katrina to talk about, I think it's the penultimate bullet point, and the way in which you and your colleagues and fine art tutors encourage students to find their own language, because I think this is perhaps a useful way forward.
And this is a really good point, because I think when we have had this, you know, when we try to teach students to find their own language, both to talk about their own work, but also to talk about the work of others, until recently, this wasn't really something that came into that discussion. But I think this must be now, you know, really front and center, because we, you know, I think very often students think about this in terms of maybe their identity, or other things, but what they don't then think about is how they understand that identity in terms of, for instance, the colonizing. And I think this is particularly perhaps the true for students who might be in a way the majority group, or who may feel very at home in an educational setting, because they don't encounter not understanding or feeling so uncomfortable perhaps. But it's maybe even more important in some ways for those students to really engage with those ideas, and understand what, you know, the kind of the function of language within that that area.
Thank you. And I think that notion of not understanding and not understandingness, and the way in which perhaps occupying a third space, a critical space in a fine art crit is a useful place for us to stop and perhaps open up questions to our audience. Thank you, Katrina.
Thank you, Victoria.